We sometimes think of ourselves on a path, a straight path or a meandering path, but nevertheless a path that goes from point A to point B, one that leads somewhere, hopefully somewhere better than we are today. Although real life, we know, is not always such a straight shot, less 50-yard dash, more merry-go-rounds, less upward and onward forever, and more seasons and cycles, up times and down times, facing the same lessons over and over, forming new answers, each time deeper, wider, or just different. Year by year, generation by generation, again and again. We stand on the shoulders of the generations who have gone before us, who have learned lessons and asked questions in their day, who don't have pre-made answers for us, but stories that encourage us to explore our questions, like, how shall we find our freedom? How shall we escape from the darkness of self or other made prisons and glimpse those stars under that brilliant desert sky? And will we end up somewhere better than we are today? Passover is an invitation from those who came before to enter into a timeless story. Imagine ourselves in it as though we are ourselves in bondage in Egypt, as though we are seeking freedom, as though we are wandering in the desert, lost and uncertain. And for the courageous among us, perhaps we can look for ourselves also in the story of Pharaoh, the repressor of freedom, the oppressor of others. We're invited to bring our questions and place ourselves in the story. And it's quite a story. I get something new out of it every time I read it, so I want to review it with you today. And I invite us to picture ourselves there as an Israelite held as a slave in Egypt, subject to backbreaking labor, compelled to build roads, towns, and cities for Pharaoh, ruler of their day. It went on like that, day after day after day, 430 years. No glimmer of light, no hope of change, nothing but drudgery and subjugation on the horizon. Until somehow, one day, God calls on this man named Moses, who becomes a chosen one, God appears to him in a burning bush, calls on him to lead his people and help them, free them. He sends Moses to Pharaoh with a message, "Let my people go. Let my people go." Pharaoh, predictably, refuses, in spite of Moses' dire warnings of trouble. And trouble comes, right? 10 different plagues rain down on the people of Egypt. The waters of the river Nile are turned to blood. There's the plagues of frogs, then lice, then wild animals invade the cities. Next, livestock come down with a mysterious, deadly illness, and the Egyptians themselves contract a terrible skin disease before fire and ice pour down from the sky in a devastating hail. The people of Egypt beg their Pharaoh to just make it stop, let the Israelites go, end their suffering, but Pharaoh remains hard-hearted. So the devastation grinds on. Locusts infest crops, destroying remaining food, and a thick, palpable darkness covers the land. Finally, there is the hardest, harshest plague of all. The angel of death comes and takes the firstborn livestock and firstborn child of every Egyptian family. Only the houses of Jewish families who had followed special instructions were passed over that night. In what we can imagine is a tortured state of seeing no way out, Pharaoh finally relents. He lets their people go. And the Israelites are told to depart quickly, packing just a few belongings, not even waiting for the bread to rise. They must make haste under cover of darkness and leave before it's too late. Moses, his brother, and over 600,000 men, plus women and children and livestock and whatever possessions they can gather, rush out into the night, making their way to Canaan, to the promised land, making their way back home. It was barely days before Pharaoh, in what we can imagine is some fit of rageful remorse, changes his mind and rushes out in hot pursuit. Chariots, horses, captains, foot soldiers, and priests marched after the Israelites, quickly catching up to the beleaguered runaways who were surely terrified and helpless, stuck at the shores of the Red Sea. When that big miracle happens, Moses lifts his staff, the waves part, the Israelites cross. When the Egyptians rush in after them, the waters come back together, drowning them all. A young boy coming home from Sunday school one day summarizes it all for his mom. "It was amazing," he told her. "Moses was this big guy, probably played football in college. Well, he tackled Pharaoh and knocked him down. While the Pharaoh was getting up, Moses quickly gathered the Israelites together and they all ran toward the river. As soon as they could get there, Moses had his corps of engineers throw up a pontoon bridge. Then they all got across, and when the Egyptians were on the bridge, Moses called in air support and they blew the whole thing up." There was a bit of silence before his mother cleared her throat and asked him, "So that's what your Sunday school teachers taught you?" "Not really," he replied. "But if I told you the story the way they did, you'd never believe it." It is quite a story. And it's a story, whether believable or not, whether true or not, that offers truth in the myth, as they say, offers perspectives, ways to think about things, lessons we humans seem to have need to keep learning again and again. In her commentary on this greatest of escape stories, Aviva Zornberg, scholar of Torah and rabbinic literature, lifts up some of the most compelling and surprising insights from this ancient tale, insights that might center us in our journeys. Like Moses, for example, such an interesting pick as liberator of his people. Turns out he's kind of a headstrong foot dragger. He doesn't at first seem all that interested in freeing his people and initially refuses to do it altogether. The Moses in the Bible isn't actually all that much like the impressive, towering, bearded figure from that movie, The Ten Commandments, who was strong and clear and powerful. The Moses we meet in the Bible is full of doubt, hesitation, and downright stubbornness. Not only does he refuse God's first request to be savior of his people, he doubts just about everything God has to say to him. I don't know about you, but I don't have a lot of trouble identifying with a guy like that. "I can't do it," he says to the God of the burning bush. "I can't do it, not smart enough. I don't speak well. They won't listen to me. Your plan has issues. It won't work out. Send someone if you want, as long as it's not me." The chutzpah, really. It's fascinating to me not only that a character in the Bible would talk to God that way, but even more that God takes it. Well, sort of, anyway. I mean, God does get mad, but somehow seems to empathize with Moses anyway and actually helps him, recognizes his human needs and fears and says basically, okay, fine. Your brother can go with you. He'll do the talking. You don't have to do it alone. So Moses and his brother go off to talk to Pharaoh. You could call them the very first ministry team. I don't mind identifying with Moses, however, because his story doesn't end with stubborn foot dragging. Somehow, somewhere, he gets it. He learns he can do this. He has the help he needs and that what he's doing matters. He becomes that hero that we imagine he always was. I can't help but think that once he became willing to start, something along his journey changed him. Then, at the other end of the story, there's Pharaoh, the villain, the antagonist to Moses' protagonist. Pharaoh is cruel, self-centered, controlling, and unjust. But the thing that strikes me most about him and his story is this whole business of the hardening of his heart. We hear, as the plagues come, one after the other, that he hardens his heart each time, is how some translations put it. He cuts himself off and he doesn't have to feel. Then, notably, after the sixth plague, it is suddenly God, not Pharaoh himself, who hardens Pharaoh's heart, as though it's no longer his own choice, as though God suddenly took over. Which creates a puzzle when you think about the theology, the logic of the lessons behind these stories. Why would God do that? Why would God appear to take charge of someone's heart, making them do bad things? It flies in the face of Jewish and Christian understandings of human autonomy and free will. But the Jewish Midrash, the Jewish commentary, offers an interesting, though troubling, interpretation that the God language is really just a figure of speech, that it really is us, that we can make ourselves so cut off, so hardened, so unhearing, that it becomes automatic, as though God did it for us. That while we have choice for a while, we can lose it. We can become unreachable if we stay hard for too long. It's a sobering reminder to me, when I am tempted to harden my heart, how can we keep our hearts open while there is still time? But an even more interesting sub-story to me in the drama of Pharaoh is what happens in the very last moment for him. He's let their people go. He's freed them from slavery, trauma over, drama over. No more hail, no more pestilence, no more untimely death. Relative peace, finally. So why did he change his mind and go after them after all? Midrash puts it very provocatively, Zornberg notes, and says something like this, that Pharaoh feels that as long as he had the Israelites in his power, God was sending him messages. Messages being the term for the plagues, an interesting euphemism. That somehow Pharaoh had some kind of very dramatic, intense relationship with God. That he had the feeling God needed him, that he was important. And now when the people are gone and life is back to normal, the sense of drama is gone and life becomes quite boring. There's a sense that Pharaoh has strangely enjoyed being in the middle of this intense, dramatic, even deadly storm. A phenomenon we sometimes see in world leaders. But it is also a phenomenon, if we pay close attention, we might see in ourselves. How we regular folk can get stuck in turmoil so we don't have to tolerate the tedium of everyday life. We can be drawn to negative drama. It's oddly enticing until it drowns us. Pharaoh's inability to tolerate a lesson in loss, a lesson in humility, ultimately destroys him. Zornberg says he's almost in a trance. Addictions of all kinds work that way. Addiction to substances, gambling, drugs, drama, Netflix. Right? So I ask myself, how does this apply to me? What do I do with my Netflix subscription? Where am I in a trance? What am I addicted to? Where could I use a lesson in humility? And then there's the people. We have Moses, the leader, Pharaoh, the bad guy, and then there are these people, the followers, who spend 40 years wandering in the desert, who are, in that time, beset with angst, irritation, and mistrust, who follow their leader, sort of, but mostly spend a lot of time complaining and doubting him and the God who got them into this mess, or at least that's how it looks to them now, a big, unfavorable, unpleasant mess. They've forgotten the great escape, forgotten the miracle of new life that was given to them, forgotten that their God might just be on their side. Instead, they complain about the food, their fears, the unknown. They want to turn back. Being slaves in Egypt was better than this, they said. Even being trapped, subjugated, lost, and helpless, even that was better than this. It has been measured that the journey from Egypt to Canaan to the Promised Land, even on foot, even with 600,000 men and women and children and livestock, that the trip should take about 80 days, maybe 70, maybe 100. But the people in this epic saga, you'll note, spend 40 years wandering in that desert wilderness. That's a long time. In one explanation for this I read, it's because God got mad. God saw the people were ungrateful and is punishing them with this near endless trek in this dry, dusty desert place. In another explanation for this I read, it's because God was wise, knew the people needed this wilderness journey and is helping them, knew the people needed to get out of familiar routines and deal with unpleasantness in order to learn to work and live together in new ways. Either way, it's ironic that when the people complained that their time in the desert was too hard, they got a whole lot more of it. I will say, I like that second explanation a lot better than the first, that they got more time because they needed more time. Their complaining wasn't a transgression to be punished, but a symptom of a need. They weren't yet ready to arrive. Their complaining about discomfort was, ironically, a sign they needed to stay in discomfort until they could fashion out of their struggles a new relationship with reality, with God, and with each other. So, I don't have a lot of trouble identifying with Moses, that stubborn foot dragger. And I can identify with Pharaoh and this risk of hardening my heart or getting addicted to negative drama, falling into trances, needing lessons in humility. And I can identify with those people, those headstrong people who get annoyed and irritated and need to wander and eventually learn to trust themselves, trust each other, and trust that if they listen to the voice of conscience, the voice of love, to a voice which some call God, they will be led. And that perhaps not in spite of, but because of their struggles, their experience of the place they are going might just be better than where they are today. 40 years in the desert. Easier to have died in Egypt or stayed a slave, pretending there was safety in the old familiar. There is no safety, only the terrible blessing of the journey. God did not promise that we shall live, but that we might, at last, glimpse the stars, brilliant in the desert sky. May it be so. Amen.